south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander, my thoughts ever stray.
Hi, everybody. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire in Latin America. I tell it just like it is, so let's get started. Today I'm going to start out with an email question, okay? And this one's from Richard. He says, when I move down to Latin America and look around for business ideas, will my business or businesses be only targeting that top 10% of the population that actually has disposable income? Or have people been successful in targeting the masses? You know, that's a question I get a lot from people. First of all, expat wannabes always seem to look at what a decent wage or salary is up in the first world, and they use that as a guideline or a base as to whether they can make a successful business down here in Latin America or not. For example, if you're used to making $60,000 a year in the States, you could shoot for that income range in your mind when you come down to Latin America, but it's really not necessary. I know this seems hard to swallow, but don't come down here thinking you have to make a first world style income. Or you're going to be unnecessarily stressed out. And you're coming down to shed some of that first world stress, aren't you? So why shouldn't you shoot for your old first world income or even better? Well, there's nothing wrong with that, but the truth is, it's not really that useful to use first world standards like that. Especially after you're here a while and you realize that a business kicking out 20,000 bucks a year down here is like a business kicking out 80 grand up in the States. A business up in Chicago, let's say, kicking out 20 grand a year would be an embarrassment. It would be considered a joke, an utter failure. So first of all, you wannabes, when you're thinking of coming down here, it's a big mistake to use the same economic measurements that you use for success up in the first world. Because the fact is, I know tons of expats down here who run little small businesses, maybe even part-time, not even full-time, and they're pulling in $20,000 or $30,000 or $35,000 a year, and they're as happy as clams and living like kings. So it's a big mistake for you wannabes sitting up there at your kitchen table in Cleveland to judge any proposed Latin American business venture that you might be hatching on first world terms. Because the rules are very different. In fact, is down here, a lot of times you make your own rules. For example, just the other day I was sitting together with a bunch of guys talking about an idea to buy 10 to 50 acres of marginal crap land, dirt cheap, then plant a really fast-growing hardy crop, of which there's dozens to choose from, and start producing alcohol. You know, to power your car's engine instead of gasoline. Because these days, every single car from the factory comes with the capability of running at least a 50-50 alcohol gas mix. And down in Brazil, as you might know, most cars can run on 95% alcohol. Now, from my understanding, if you wanted to do this kind of thing up in the States, you know, get some land, grow a crop, and use it for alcohol, you could actually produce up to 2,000 gallons of alcohol an acre for about 60 cents to a dollar a gallon. And that's with your typical U.S. one growing season, using first world manpower and those high first world labor costs. Now, we've done some numbers down here where the land is much cheaper. You get four growing seasons and all the farm laborers you can handle that'll work for 10 or 12 bucks a day. And our numbers say we could produce alcohol as a fuel for about 30 to 50 cents a gallon and easily produce about 4,000 gallons an acre per year, double the yield per acre in the first world. So anyway, me and a few expats are toying around with this idea, and one of the guys in the group says, I don't know about that. You're definitely going to butt heads with the government, you know, competing with big oil companies for a chunk of their business. They're definitely not going to like that, and I bet there's going to be quite a few legal obstacles you're going to have to overcome. I mean, what if you can't get the permits to produce this stuff or to sell it? And what about the taxing authorities? You know, they got a huge tax on gas down here. What about alcohol? You start producing that stuff, and they're liable to ball you up with all kinds of red tape. You might get the whole damn thing going and run into a brick wall made out of government paperwork. But luckily, we had a local lawyer sitting there at the table with us. A lawyer, by the way, who has a few local oil companies for clients. And he just laughed and he said, I think we should do this alcohol thing. And he said that there were virtually no rules or regulations on alcohol production unless you're selling it as an intoxicating beverage. Then he went on to point out that all the sugar companies in Latin America are self-sufficient energy-wise. They use no gasoline or petroleum products at all. Why? Because they make their own alcohol on the premises. When they refine the sugar cane, they get molasses, then they process that down to alcohol, and they run their trucks and their sorters and their car fleets, and they run their own electric generators with the stuff too. And what's the government's position on that? Well, they say and do absolutely nothing about it. And even if they wanted to, they haven't got the time, energy, or the manpower to even go out to these places and check up on what these guys are doing. In other words, what the lawyer said was, don't worry about the red tape, because there ain't any. Now, if you tried to do this up in the first world, you know, start your own alcohol production facility from scratch, talk about paperwork, regulations, and red tape. Not to mention environmental impact studies, transportation department inspectors, and EPA people. Up in the States, the alphabet agencies that could mess with a project like that, they'd be on you like flies on cow pies. That is, unless you're producing under 2,000 gallons a year, which is a regulation that's been around for a long time that allows farmers to make the stuff and power their own equipment. But if you were to try selling it on the open market, forget about it, at least for now. But down here in Latin America, well, the path has already been blazed by Brazil, which no longer imports any petroleum at all. More than half of that country's fuel is alcohol, and they're pushing to make Brazil 85% alcohol by 2020. No one in their right mind wants to depend on the Middle East or the Russians or Venezuela for their oil. And if you're a country with huge tracts of marginal land and cheap labor, making alcohol is a no-brainer. And since startup costs are very cheap, and you could buy the technology ready-made right off the shelf, it's an ideal business for expats. Especially since down here now, gasoline prices are from $4 to $5 a gallon. Except, of course, in Venezuela, which has a huge subsidy, so they don't count. And I know, as usual, I've gotten a little bit off the subject, but the point I was trying to make, that unlike in the first world, when you're starting a business down here, you just have no alphabet agencies to deal with, aside from the usual suspects, like the tax guys, the building inspectors, and the health and sanitation guys. So get used to the pleasant fact that governments down here, they don't have 25 or 50 agencies watching every little move you make when you start a business, no matter how big or small. The fact is, you could create a business from start to finish down here and never step one foot into a government office at all. Your lawyer, of course, will do all that for you. So back to that original email question. Who is your market? Well, that all depends if you're on or off the gringo tourist trail. Because, of course, if you're on that tourist trail, there will be three different markets to choose from. There's the tourists, of course. Then there's the upper 5 or 10% of the population that has extra money to spend. Then there's the masses, the people making $300 or $400 a month. And since they've got almost no extra spending money, if that's your market, you'll have to do huge volumes. Like, for example, opening up a Dairy Queen or a Subway franchise. That'll be for the masses. Just remember, there's one huge drawback when you're opening up a business on the tourist trail. Your competition will not be the locals. You're going to be in competition with a bunch of other gringos who got down there before you and had the same idea. And those are exactly the people you don't want to be in competition with. But unfortunately, many green expats come down and make that very mistake. Anyway, I've had green expats and expat wannabes try to argue this point with me. They say, look, Johnny, what if I'm really good at something, or I have a fresh, brand new idea, and I take it down to Costa Rica or Panama? Wouldn't I naturally clean up if I'm the first guy down there with that idea? And you know what I say to those guys? You're absolutely right. If you're the first guy down there with something, you will clean up. If, and only if, the marketing and the advertising have already been done for you. In other words, your market, whether it's the tourists or the masses, have to be aware that your product now exists down there, and there has to be a certain amount of built-in or pent-up demand. And believe me, if you're the first one down with a new product, you're not going to be able to do two things at once. Stock and sell that item, whatever it is, and create the market for it too. And that's why these first-world franchises like Subway, McDonald's, Wendy's, Kentucky Fried, even Starbucks, do so well right out of the gate. That's because the marketing and the brand recognition has already been done way in advance through first-world TV and media. And Latins, you know, are addicted to first-world cable TV and stuff. But if they never saw or heard of a Kentucky Fried or a Subway before, you could open up 100 of those things and nobody would come. But the Latins are bombarded with that stuff on U.S. cable TV and media outlets, so the demand is already there, way in advance. And there's another problem with that argument of, well, Johnny, I'll bring down a new product and I'll clean up. Okay, I say, show me that new idea that no one's brought down yet. Sure, I've seen expats do it off the tourist trail all the time. They bring a product down. It's not new to us first worlders, but it hasn't landed in San Pedro Sula, Honduras yet. And suddenly, you're the only Applebee's, or Mailbox, etc., or Kinko's in a city of almost 1 million people. And all of a sudden, you're raking in the cash. So yes, that idea works fine when you're off the tourist trail. In fact, that's one of the keys to a quick success. Check out what is available in that town or area, and look for a niche that you can fill. But just a warning about those heavily gringoized areas. When I pass through a gringo tourist area, there's always so many gringos around that nearly every business niche has been filled. And it's not a good idea to compete against those guys. I mean gringo businessmen. But often on the tourist trail, I see early retired couples come down and try their hand at a business, and they don't do it to necessarily make a lot of money. Nor do they care about competition, even if it's gringo competition. They just need to have something to do. Like I said, you'll have a lot of time on your hands, so you're going to need a hobby or two. And if your business and hobby are one and the same, let's say you love to cook and you start a restaurant, then the normal rules of business sometimes don't apply. Let me explain. You see, most of the early retired couples that I meet have a pretty nice nest egg, a pretty nice cushion. So they come down to a place like Panama or Costa Rica and try to live out their retirement dream by starting a bed and breakfast or a restaurant. These new owners, these early retirees, are more than likely going to be living on the premises and working full-time with no pay, and more to the point, they've got that big cushion, nest egg, that they can tap every time they run short. So technically, when you're on the tourist trail, a lot of these mom-and-pop bed and breakfasts, hotels, restaurants, and tourist and hospitality businesses are just barely breaking even. But since they're not actually losing money, the husband and wife team, and it usually is a husband and wife, just keep plugging along year after year, even though any first world business accountant worth his salt would have told that couple to pack it in a long time ago. But if you're living out your retirement dream and it's your hobby too, even if you're not making any money, it's still a pretty good life. So that's a little known secret about mom and pop and small expat owned businesses on the tourist trail. A large percentage of them are just breaking even. And basically, the owners aren't that concerned because they've made it to paradise and they've got a social security check and a nest egg too. But back to Richard's email question. Now here's another thing to consider. If you're going to bring a first world franchise down here to Latin America, and like I said, at least 90% of these things end up as gold mines for the owners. Anyway, if you bring a franchise down, 95% of the time you're going to be targeting the masses. Now of course I'm assuming if you do buy a franchise, you're going to get into one of the lower priced franchises, maybe under $150,000, or even much less than that. Because you see, if you go for one of the higher priced franchises, like for example, Sizzlers or Tony Roma's, or even TGIF's, Chili's, or Applebee's, you're looking at $500,000 or more at least. And down here, those places aren't your neighborhood corner restaurants. They're going to be located in the higher end districts of town. And of course, those places are marketed to the masses up in the first world, but down here, the masses will not be able to afford that kind of stuff. For example, a trip to TGIF's or Applebee's is more than what the average guy can afford when taking his girlfriend out for a Saturday night. Because, you know, you're talking about guys here who make $300 a month. The fact is, when an average middle-class guy takes his girlfriend out for a date, he doesn't take her to Chili's or TGIF's, he takes her to McDonald's or Pizza Hut. So what I've noticed, as a rule down here, the bigger, more expensive franchises, like Sizzler or TGIF or Tony Roma's, they're not owned by individual expats who had the idea to bring a franchise down. In almost all the cases I've seen, a consortium of wealthy Latin businessmen will buy 3 or 4 Chili's franchises and bring them into some of the big cities in their country all at one time. And these consortiums of wealthy Latin guys I'm talking about have a lot of old money behind them. They're the helicopter crowd. Their parents own beer companies and sugar plantations and stuff. And these guys are always jetting back and forth to the United States. They have 1 foot in Latin America and 1 foot in the first world. And they know what a success some of these franchises are up in the first world. But not only are these franchises much more expensive than, let's say, a Subway or a Quick Heel shoe fix-it shop, they're also much more vulnerable to failure because only the upper 10% of the population can afford to go there. So these higher end franchises are kind of tricky. You have to place them in the right part of the city, which is the higher rent district, where you always have parking and traffic problems too. And though you certainly can't stick a franchise like that just anywhere, they always seem to draw big crowds because, after all, they come directly from the first world, and Latins love everything and anything that has to do with it. And you know, I've walked through a lot of these more expensive franchises, like Skillet's, for example, which of course is strictly middle class in the States. Even IHOP has landed down here, and that's strictly lower class, like Denny's up north. Which just goes to show how the gringo advantage can turn everything topsy-turvy. In our favor, of course. But don't get me wrong, sometimes you do see these expensive franchises from the first world with practically no customers in the parking lot at all. And you wonder, how can these businesses crack their nut like that? Well, aside from the fact that labor costs are a fifth of what they'd be up in the first world, the prices at these places are not third world at all. They're absolutely first world. The franchise itself sets the prices worldwide, not you. And that's a huge reason why even places that look marginal often are surviving quite nicely. It's like this. McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, and all the rest of them still basically charge $3 or $4 for a hamburger combo, but they only pay their help $1.50 to $2 an hour. Whereas up in the States, the very same McDonald's or Wendy's has to pay $7 an hour plus benefits. So figure it out. You don't need a full house of customers to keep a place like that going. In fact, in Latin America, your average first world fast food franchise like Popeyes, Domino's, or Kentucky Fried could survive quite nicely on just a quarter of the traffic flow that the identical franchise would need if it were up in the States. And the same is true for a much more expensive franchise like TGIF's. So, two easy ways for expats to get started with a brick-and-mortar business. Start your own little mom-and-pop thing, or bring down a franchise. And yes, there are thousands upon thousands of franchises that haven't made it down here yet. And because it's so easy to make small franchises work down here, expats who do that often end up building an empire. But it's not necessary to have a franchise to build such an empire. An expat friend of mine from Germany came down to Guatemala City about 15 years ago and just could not find a good Italian restaurant. Sure, they had Italian restaurants, Latin style, of course. But, like he said, every restaurant seemed to be the same. People went there all right, they had plenty of customers, but the pasta was always soggy, the food too salty, the sauce always tasted like watered-down ketchup, and no one had one of those nice imported espresso machines. 15 or so years ago, that stuff didn't exist. Instead, you got percolator coffee. Yuck. In Guatemala, that's what passed for an Italian restaurant. And the atmosphere, even worse. No scenes of Venice, Milan, or gondolas. And the music? No trace of Dean Martin, Perry Como, Vic Damone, or even Frank Sinatra. And when you got your little basket of bread, it was your regular sliced white bread. And you know that Italian staple, Chianti in a wicker basket on your table? Non-existent. The closest thing to red Italian table wine was this rot-gut cheap red wine from Chile, Gato Negro. Double yuck. So, my German buddy, dying for a good Italian restaurant, decided there was a little niche to be filled. So he went down to the historic district in Guatemala City and opened up a tiny little hole-in-the-wall Italian restaurant right across the street from the federal buildings and the halls of Congress. And being that Tom was a fastidious German, he really Italianized it. Dean Martin, amore, and all. Like he said, it didn't take much to kill the competition. There was no competition. And now, more than a dozen years later, I guess he has about 20 or more restaurants. And every time I run into him, he's always asking me over to his beach house or offering to take me up for a ride in his plane. Yep, his private plane. And here's a guy that came down to Guatemala with about $2,000 to his name. He didn't speak a lick of Spanish, and his English wasn't that great either. And now he's got more than 20 restaurants, owns a few bars, has a few German sports cars, and sent all four of his kids to private schools in the States and Europe. And all that happened to him because he couldn't find a good Italian restaurant. And the odd thing about it is he did all that being German and not Italian. But then again, Hitler and Mussolini had a thing going now, didn't they? And back to the original question of who do you market to? Well, in Tom's case, with his first little hole-in-the-wall joint, he wasn't really marketing to the masses because they already had their trashy low-end restaurants. And he didn't really want to compete with them and their rock-bottom prices. He said if he was going to use real good ingredients, real mozzarella, olive oil, real Italian pasta, a real expensive espresso machine, and not use ketchup in his sauce, his prices would necessarily have to be a little higher than in the trashier joints. So for him, his first market was to government employees, basically to all those suits and their underlings that came in and out of those government buildings every day. Now, his logic was this. All government employees make about twice or even more what that same job pays in the private sector. So he was smack dab in the middle of a section of town where the people actually did have a little extra spending money for lunch and dinner. And what's his market now, over a dozen years later? Well, he still is a cut above the average skanky Italian joints I was talking about before. But he does not market to the upper or upper middle classes. He runs his ads on the radio and the local TV stations. His prices are just a shade above Domino's and Little Caesars. Yet when you walk into one of his restaurants, there's no resemblance to a fast food joint. And of course, people with real money would never go there, because now throughout Guatemala City, there are real 100% bona fide Italian restaurants actually owned and operated by Italians or Latins who are part Italian. And by local standards, these are elegant, high-class restaurants. But to us first-worlders, again, imminently cheap. I mean, you'd have a hard time spending 20 bucks on yourself in a place like that, which leaves out about 90% of the population of Latin America. So, there you have it. My friend Tom found his perfect niche between elegant and mediocre. And many years ago, when he first decided to put in his first restaurant, he told me he would have preferred to have opened a real elegant Italian restaurant with a nice big wine cellar and all, but he didn't, because he only had 2,000 bucks. And by the way, the Gringo Advantage works for Europeans too. Now Tom says he's very glad he didn't have the money to open an elegant Italian restaurant. Because like he says, no matter how successful an elegant restaurant might have been, franchising a high-end restaurant like that is almost impossible. Even big Latin cities can only afford to support a few high-end Italian restaurants. But small, inexpensive franchises, you can stick one of those in every shopping mall. So the moral of that story is, down in Latin America, sometimes you don't pick your market. Your market picks you. Now I'd like to change the subject a bit. I'm sure you all know by now that I'm doing another seminar in Latin America in January. And just lately, I've been getting a lot of inquiries from single women. They want to become permanent expats too, but many of them are a little bit gun-shy about coming down alone. And that's why I think it's a good time right now for me to read this letter from one of our single female participants in the last seminar, who also had serious second thoughts about coming down even after she'd signed up. So let me read you Lily's letter. Not her real name, by the way. Why would you go to Guatemala? What is even in Guatemala? Where is Guatemala? Is that next to Argentina or Chile? Isn't it unsafe there because it's right next to Mexico? Then Lily puts in parentheses a note to herself. Duh. Reminder, the U.S. is also right next to Mexico. Then she continues with the letter. Isn't Guatemala a drug haven? My nail lady is from Guatemala and she seems nice. Those were comments that people made when I said I might be going to Guatemala. You have to love the ignorance of most Americans. After about a day, I realized I wouldn't tell anyone that I was going. Someone that is near and dear to me recommended me to Johnny and his show. I remember when I first started listening. I was thinking to myself, with all of these negative things that Johnny says about Latin America, why would I ever want to move there or do business there? At the same time, Johnny had a real sense of calmness and contentment in his voice that was quite refreshing. He seemed to really be enjoying life and living without regret of leaving the U.S. I have learned from my other international trips not to read the State Department's website because I would talk myself out of traveling. In any event, my curiosity and my sense of caution made me review the website and I almost canceled my trip. I contacted Johnny to make sure, in his opinion, that I would be safe at the seminar. He assured me that I would be fine, but I wasn't fully convinced. That said, I decided the opportunity was worth it and would take the necessary precautions to prepare myself and make sure that I would be safe while I was there. I remember arriving at the airport, and it is just as Johnny described. It's very clean and organized and far more modern than I'd imagined. The people were extremely friendly, and the immigration officials actually made me feel very welcome in their country. When I exited the airport, I was looking around for the expat wisdom sign, and then had the pleasure of meeting Johnny for the first time. That's where the adventure started. Transportation was provided to the hotel, which reminded me of a very typical hotel in any major urban area in the U.S. The seminar unfolded just as Johnny described it in his show. I also stayed for the post-seminar days, and that was well worth it. I should also mention that Guatemala is a truly beautiful country and the weather is perfect. There are many ways in which someone can go about exploring areas of the world as a potential place to live and work. I can't imagine ever moving or doing business in a place where my feet haven't spent some time on the ground. That said, just visiting a country and staying as a tourist is not the same as really experiencing the country through the eyes of someone that has lived there and done business there for a long period of time. That insight is the very essence of what made this seminar so valuable. Spending 8 days with Johnny out and about in Guatemala and hearing how it really is in Guatemala and not how the media portrays the country was something that doesn't have a price tag. Every country and every culture and people have the outside image and then the in-the-know reality. Johnny provided the in-the-know on the country. He didn't sugarcoat things and he didn't try to convince us to do anything. He just spoke the truth. I would be remiss at this point not to mention the other remarkable people that Johnny introduced us to during the seminar. In addition, I have to mention that being able to be around a group of like-minded people was quite refreshing. I had the fortunate opportunity to really get to know a few of the other attendees, and they have become good friends. I have to say that I was a skeptic going into the seminar and coming out of the seminar, but I couldn't imagine not having gone. It was a real eye-opening experience for me and showed me firsthand that moving abroad and or doing business abroad is very possible. In addition, it really reminded me of all the things we have to stress and deal with on a daily basis in the U.S. that simply don't exist in other areas of the world. Sometimes you need to remove yourself from the treadmill before you can realize that you're even on a treadmill. Quote, courage is not the absence of fear, but rather the judgment that something else is more important than fear. Unquote. Ambrose Redman. And finally, Lily says, Guatemala is a hidden jewel and Johnny is a diamond in the rough. I would highly recommend this seminar. That's how the letter ends. And by the way, if you're interested in my next seminar in January, just go to expatwisdom.com and click the seminar link. And that goes for you single ladies who are on the fence about it too.
South of the border, down Mexico way.
You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, coming to you each week from somewhere south of the border. And don't forget, you can email me on anything at all about Latin America, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. See you next time. Nos vemos.
She was a picture.